From Acts chapter 26, verses 24 through 26. Acts 26, 24 through 26. And as he was saying these things in his defense, Festus said with a loud voice, "Paul, you are out of your mind. Your great learning is driving you out of your mind." But Paul said, "I am not out of my mind, most excellent Festus, but I am speaking true and rational words. For the king knows about these things, and to him I speak boldly. For I am persuaded that none of these things has escaped his notice, for this has not been done in a corner."
Hope everyone is doing well tonight. Had the privilege and the honor of going to Faulkner University's lectures. They're known as the Curly Lectures. And there, they talk about things that most people aren't interested in, if I'm being honest. Things like, does Mark 16, 9 through 20 belong in the New Testament? The average person, it's in there. It's got parentheses, but it's in there, right? But the thing that I liked about it is the fact that in this particular conference and in one of the particular sessions, one of the people who was for Mark 16, 9 through 20 presented their paper, and the person that was against Mark 16, 9 through 20 being in there in the New Testament, seen as canonical, presented their paper. Afterward, they questioned each other, and then they got questions from the audience. And it was really beneficial. I knew most of the material already, but the methodology is what I was interested in. And it was a blessing to see that two people who were very learned could still disagree on things, and not everything was as clear-cut as it initially looked. And that brings us to our question tonight. Why are young people leaving the church? As Tim said this morning, I've been working on this a little bit, particularly because I knew that summer was going to get ridiculously busy, so I wanted to start it early. But it's been something that's been on my mind for a while, too, because I hear the question quite a bit, and I thought tonight I would share some thoughts with you. You're going to hear all kinds of statistics, and we're not going to go into depth, too much in depth right now with those, but generally you'll hear things like, well, it's not as bad as people make it out to be. That's the one thing you'll hear from some people. People aren't really leaving as much as we say it is, as they are. On the other hand, you'll have, well, the next generation's going apostate and there's nothing we can do and, you know, good luck with it. That's the other end of the spectrum, right? And then in the middle, you've got all kinds of varying discussions going on about what the statistics are. However, that doesn't answer the question, does it? Why are young people leaving the church? So why are they leaving? There have been some studies done into this, but usually they go something like this. Well, they're leaving for the denominational churches. But does that answer the question? No, it doesn't answer the question. It gives us the effect, but it doesn't tell us the cause. They're leaving because of leadership issues. They're leaving because they don't know the basics of Christianity. Maybe others have heard, well, the church is not perceived as loving like it should be. Others will say, well, it's because of all the man-made rules that we have in the church. And maybe there's something there, but I've got a different one that I've not heard too many people speak on, which at first made me kind of leery about presenting it, but after talking with some of my friends and particularly a conversation that I was having with a man that's been in the kingdom, a worker in the kingdom for years today, he said that he agrees and that there's been others that have written about it as well, so I guess if it's in writing, it must be true, right? Imagine this. We're going to take a step back for a second before we get to why they're leaving. Let's put ourselves in a freshman high school level person's shoes today. We walk into high school. What's the first thing we're worried about? Maybe our first concern is, who am I? What am I going to be? Am I going to be a jock? Am I going to be a nerd? Am I going to be a dork? Am I going to be an emo? And I would dare say that each of us struggle with identity at some point in our lives and how we fit into the larger culture that we're in. But maybe you have to worry about all your social media as well and all the information that you're bombarded with. And you'll say, but Greg, I wouldn't be on social media if I were a teen today. And to that I say, no, you probably would, because we're generally like our generation that we're in. So there's that. But then 2 weeks ago, you had a friend who came up to you and said, you know, I'm having strange feelings that I've never felt before. And it's kind of weird, but I'm kind of attracted to guys. You have another friend who comes up to you and says, you know, I'm dealing with gender identity issues right now, and I don't know what to do. I'm going to read you a text that I received from a youth. They're not a youth here, but I'll read it to you. This is verbatim. If your spouse has been transgendered, gender reassignment, and they do not tell you until after you are married, would you be committing a homosexual sin? Would it be sin to marry them even if you knew that they had been, quote, resexed? I had another question posed to me like this, and this has been asked multiple times of me, believe it or not. If a person is a man and becomes a woman, would it be wrong for that person to now like men? And you know what? I love questions like this. I hate the fact that we have to ask them. I don't like that part of it. But I love the fact that they're being asked. It tells me that we're thinking, and that's always a good thing. You see, my contention today is that many of our young people are not challenged to think for themselves. And I really don't have anyone in mind here. So if you think Greg's talking about you, that's on you, not on me. So... But I do know some people that make all of their youth's decisions for them. Down to what they'll wear, what they'll eat, everything. And so, because they've not thought for themselves, I know some youth who, after going off to college, they've heard things that they've never heard before, and they don't have any paradigm as to how they process that information. Because it doesn't fit into their paradigm, they're going, whoa, what else has mom and dad kept from me? And these are the people that have been at class twice a week and they've been at the sermon twice a week. So let me ask you this. How would you define this word? Liberal. Now, the way I usually used to define this word was, anybody that didn't agree with Greg Ryan was a liberal. And you know what? That's usually how it works, isn't it? Because we're never the liberal, right? Until we look back on it and we go, man, I was so liberal back then. But you know what's interesting? A liberal in the academic sense for Bible is somebody that doesn't believe that the Bible's inspired by God or that miracles ever existed. You see, there's this guy, and maybe you've heard the name, maybe you've not, Julius Wellhausen. He created a thing called the documentary hypothesis, and he said that there were four people who made the Torah. Four authors, J, E, D, and P. That's all they get. They don't even get full names. Four people. And he said that because of that, there are no miracles. It's these four different writers that have put together this information. And it's biblical interpretation like this that has plagued Christianity for the past century. But you may argue, but we won't let our kids go to some kind of liberal school where they're going to hear about all these Germans. Well, in middle school, one of my professors walked in, one of my teachers, and he just off the cuff made this comment. He said, you know, they've been doing some studies. And come to find out, it probably wasn't the Red Sea that Moses crossed. It was probably the Reed Sea. And the Reed Sea only comes up to about here. Now, this is middle school. I mean, what's a middle schooler supposed to do, right? And that's the kind of stuff that teachers would just make comments on. And it's also not as simple as, we'll homeschool or we'll private school or anything like that. It's also not as simple as because the Bible says so. That's not good enough for many today. And to be honest with you, until you've laid a foundation, it's not good enough for anybody. Until you've laid the right foundation. So, again, let's put ourselves in a youth's shoes. We're going to take our first walk into calculus class, and we're going to sit down. Now, here's the problem. You've never had algebra. And so you sit down, and you look up, and teacher's up there just writing away, and he's talking derivatives and log formulas and all that kind of stuff. And then you notice that there's these alphabet letters mixed in with numbers, and you're going, what is this? What on earth? And so we look in our textbook, and we see that according to the textbook, x equals 10. And yet up on the board, we see the teacher write x equals 8. How would you feel about speaking up? Most of us would probably be so overwhelmed that we'd think to ourselves, well, this guy has to know what he's doing. I mean, he's teaching the class, right? He's got to be smart. He's the authority figure in this position. I've got to trust him. So our youth go off to college, and they hear concepts from professors about biology, with evolution wrapped in there, different philosophies. They're asked questions like, how can a loving God allow evil? And they're only given two options by the professor. Either God isn't strong enough to get rid of evil, or he's not good enough to get rid of evil. Now, how would you answer it? Why does God allow evil? Well, the answer is free will. But if we've not had time to process it before we've been hit with it, it's like a hitter. If they get up there into the batting box and they've never seen a curveball, good luck trying to hit the thing, right? Another question that is posed. Can God make a rock too big for him to move? Now you may say, well, that's a ridiculous question. And I can talk to you about it later if you want an answer. But the point is that these are monumental, faith-destroying questions. And you may say, well, how is that? I know somebody that because of a certain Bible passage, the way that it talked about God, they decided to leave the church. And it was a simple story. To me, it was a story that I'd read so often that I didn't think anything of it. I'd explained it in my own mind. But this person, for them, it was monumental in their faith. So, are we exposed to concepts in which we're not accustomed to? Youth struggle with concepts like, what is truth? Is there truth? How does one define truth? And if I'm being completely blunt with you, they generally don't struggle so much with, should we use musical instruments and should we take communion once a week? Because if we can lay a good enough foundation as to what, if there is truth to begin with, then the rest can fall in line. But they struggle more with gender identity and what is truth than they do with anything else. And it's not that education is the problem. I know I've talked a lot about university and schooling after high school, but the same thing happens in churches too. Because while we have the people standing up in front, we look at them as the authority figure, right? Well, they've got to know something. I mean, they're standing in front. Why else would they stand up there? And we have them in our pulpit. We have them in our teachers. And our kids look to them, and you all look to the person presenting as the authority figure. Well, this is what we pay Greg for. He should know something. Well, test it. Try me on it first before you just take my word for it. But it also happens in work environments. If our kids don't go to college and they just go right into the work environment, guess what? They're going to see a lot of the same stuff. I know I've used this illustration before, but it's the best one I got. The first week that I started one of my jobs that I was at as a printer/server technician, the boss comes up to me and says, "Why do Christians hate homosexuals?" First week. It was before 8 a.m. What kind of talk is that at 8 in the morning? You know, your first week on the job. And my response was, we don't. We don't agree with them in their actions, but we don't hate them. So, it's interesting. It's not like education is making our children go mad. Much like Festus said to Paul, "Paul, much learning has made you mad. This Christianity stuff has made you gone quite liberal. You've left your roots, Paul." "Oh, no, no, Festus. I'm getting it right." I'm going to argue that it's actually a lack of education in terms of how to think that's the problem. The problem at this point is not solely what we think, but how we think. And I'm not just talking about our youth. I'm talking about everybody. We need a system, a methodology of how to think. And if we can have that right, then the rest will follow, I will argue. But if we're honest with ourselves, we don't do logic in schools. We don't like to be questioned. I know I don't. People struggle with critical thinking. And while this doesn't answer all the questions as to why people leave, I think that there is something here. Now, I'm an oddball, as you know. I didn't grow up in the church, and I try to question everything. In fact, in high school, it was my senior year, AP English, and I wrote a paper called "Religion is Mind Control," where I compared Gregorian chants to the chants found in Orwell's Animal Farm. And I thought I knew it. I was like, man, don't people see, you know, these chants and these singings that they do? It's just like Orwell, and it's just indoctrination. And if I had remained closed-minded, then I would dare say I wouldn't be standing in front of you right now. And so, when I look back at why I struggled with religion, a few things came to mind. My grandmother did everything that she could for me. She really did. And she tried to be as godly as she could, as best as she knew. But the poor woman. My aunt asked her one time why she was Baptist, and she said because John was. She thought John was the first Baptist, John the Baptist. Because why else would he be named that, right? She was also King James only. And she thought, essentially, that if it was good enough for Paul, then it was good enough for her. Mind you, she used the newer King James, not the new King James, but the one done in like 1792, not the 1611 version. But she did try her best. But she took me to a church when I was younger that had just a plethora of Bible thumping, okay? That's what I grew up around. I heard the sermons on hell, right? And I heard the Bible thumping, and I heard about how everyone else was wrong. And, you know, it's interesting. When I look at Jesus, does he ever talk about hell? Yeah. Matthew 25 comes to mind. Matthew 23. There are places where he talks about hell. But is that the main thing that he talks about? "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." He doesn't say, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you the fear of God to where you're afraid to take a step out of line." That's not what he says. He changes the paradigm of people to where he wants them to think about the positivity of religion, the positive nature of religion, as opposed to the negative nature of religion. He wants them to see Christianity as something that frees us, not something that keeps us captive and we have to be so fearful of, because perfect love does cast out fear. In fact, it's interesting. In 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 8 through 9, Paul writes this. He says, "Now we know that law is good if one uses it lawfully." And he's using a little bit narrower of a usage of law here, okay? Because, mind you, law can be used in a multitude of ways, right? So law here is kind of a narrower-minded, not narrow-minded, but narrower sense of the word. "Now, we know that law is good if one uses it lawfully, understanding this, that the law is not laid down for the just, but for the lawless and the disobedient, for the ungodly and the sinners, for the unholy and the profane." You see, what I grew up with in the church, the congregation where I attended, was a very shallow depth of spirituality, because all I was told was no, 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 don't, don't. That's what we do with our children. But as we mature and as we grow in our faith, we begin to see the freedoms that we have in Jesus. We begin to grow in our spiritual depth as we get past the no, 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 don't, don't. Because the no, 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 don't are for those that break the law. Now, if I steal from Walmart, I should be told, don't steal from Walmart. If I murder, I should be told, don't murder. But I don't go around going up to people and go, shouldn't murder. Okay, no, really, you need to not murder this week. It's just not something that we do, right? Because most of us have grown past that. Another reason why I struggled with religion, and again, this is, I will argue, why some others do as well, perhaps, is because I asked questions and yet people didn't want to answer them. They wanted me to just take their word for it. And you know what? No, I won't. People leave because others claim to have the answers and will explain it. In preaching school, I was known for asking oddball questions, and I'm all right with that. And I will question everything, and here's why. Because my soul is more important than perceived important traditions or beliefs. I'm more worried about my soul than stepping on the toes of others about their traditions or their beliefs. And so here's the question. When a youth or any person, for that matter, questions something, what is our response? And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to share some experiences. Some will be from me, some from what I've seen, and some from what others have shared with me, okay? About questioning. I've been brushed off for questioning things. Like, I'll ask a question and I'm told, well, I just don't have time for that right now. And you know what? That makes me feel about yay high. It makes me feel like I'm not worth anything. In fact, one of my friends, while we were in school, had that happen to him, and it got him very frustrated because it was kind of a perpetual thing with him. I've heard people told that you have to just believe, but then I read the Bereans, who are more excellent than those than at Thessalonica, because they searched the scripture even though an apostle came and told them what to believe. I know people who have been laughed at for questioning things in the Bible or people's perspectives, and I'm talking members of the church have laughed at other members of the church for questioning perspectives. How do you think that person feels that's being laughed at? I know one person that they had books about evolution taken away from them by their parents. Again, none of y'all. But this person had books taken away from them that were on evolution, and then the parent couldn't explain why evolution wasn't right. They just said, you just don't need to read those things. I've had interpretations given to me personally that were not logical or biblical. So here's one. I don't know if I've shared this before or not, but So when I first started going to a Church of Christ, Megan was bringing me, I go in there, and one of the things that you obviously notice is that we don't have any kind of instrument up here, right? It kind of sets us apart a little bit. But I was questioning things like, why don't you? And I found a tract that they had. And in the tract, it talked about how, the question was, well, aren't there going to be instruments in heaven according to Revelation? And in Revelation, it doesn't say that there are instruments in heaven. It talks about sounds like harps and such. But that's not where this person went. They didn't follow that line of argument. Instead, they said this. They said, in order for there to be harps in heaven, there have to be factories that make the harps. And I don't read any factories in heaven. I'm not kidding you. I took it to Megan. I said, do you believe this? Is this really what you all believe? I was so frustrated. I mean, talk about terrible logic. And I'm sure the brother meant well, but that's terrible. And I've also known people that have gotten angry at others because they were questioned. Yes, being asked to reevaluate our own stances, including mine, on concepts is hard. And it's hard to give answers because it requires critical thinking. And so, I know I've talked a lot about the life through the eyes of a teen today and the fact that they live in a different world than maybe what we're even accustomed to. That critical thinking, I don't think, is stressed as it once was. People don't like questions. We generally don't. But some of that may be why our teens are leaving. But now I want to talk about some solutions. What can we do, you and I, to help not just our teens, but everybody with this when they have questions? Helping people to stay faithful. Even though this isn't a guarantee, but it's the idea of what can we do to promote healthy discussion and make people actually think. Number one, we can help by being accessible. Our model that we aim for is Jesus. There's no doubt about that. But if you want to talk about the qualifications that get us closest to looking like Jesus, I'll argue that it's eldership, right? And so there's only like three things that an elder should have that every other member doesn't have to have. Number one, being a man. From what I read, not everyone has to be a man to enter into heaven. Number two, being married. Again, 1 Corinthians 7. And number three, having children. But the rest are good things for every member of the church to be, right? And one of those is hospitable. And the idea there behind the word is being friendly towards strangers. And I'm about to make a lesser to greater argument. If we're going to be friendly to strangers, how much more are we going to be friendly to those around us and accepting of those around us to open our doors, if you will, to them and saying, you know what, let's talk, let's discuss. Number two, so being accessible. Number two, encourage critical thinking. So when I think about Elijah, he goes out, and there's the Baal worshipers. And what does he say? Well, let's test it. If Baal is God, this will happen. If my God is God, then this will happen. He tests it. He says, here are the two opposing views. Let's test them. Let's work it out. You think for yourself and you figure it out. That's another thing that we can do to help our people to think. We can ask each other questions. We can question each other's core beliefs. That's a good thing. Iron sharpens iron as one man sharpens another. Let people struggle. Now, this is a tough one. This is one that we're really uncomfortable with, okay? But Jesus will tell a parable, and then he'll just leave it completely open, and he'll walk away. And people are going, what was that? what did that mean? It's because Jesus wanted them to think for themselves. He wasn't going to lay it all out there. He wanted them to be invested in the process. And let's set the bar high for our expectations and as we encourage critical thinking. Number three, be accessible, encourage critical thinking, stay humble. we all need to stay humble. If we don't know an answer, let's not try to make one up on the spot. We'll generally come to the same conclusion that the tract did. Well, you need factories to have harps, right? That's usually our off-the-cuff response, and we don't want those responses. But give it some thought. Go back to it later. Number four, start early. It's interesting. As I've gone to some of these conferences about youth development and such, one of the things that keeps coming up is the fact that by age 12 and 11, most people are pretty much set with what they're going to believe. Most people are set by age 11 and 12 with what they're going to believe for the rest of their lives. They go through a period from 13 to 19 where some things are going on, and then they hit 20, and they usually revert back to the 11 or 12-year-old foundation that you set. What's interesting is I get them when they get to be 12, to where they're already kind of set in stone. That's why a lot of churches of Christ, actually, not a lot, but there are some churches of Christ that what they're doing is they're taking their best minister and they're putting them on the zero to fourth grade level and encouraging parents to do their jobs at home, because the foundation you set by 11 and 12 is what's going to last for a lifetime for the most part. So start early. Get them to think early. Teach them the basics. And I'm not talking about musical instruments and all that. Yes, do that too. But teach them how to think. Teach them what is truth and is there truth. And those are the kind of basics I'm talking about. Let us live it. It's interesting that during the Passover, one of the things that's said is that your children are going to recognize that you're doing something, and you'll have to give them an answer for what you're doing. Do our kids ask us about communion? Do our kids talk to us about what we're doing, about our faith in Jesus? Oh, they're smart. They're smart, aren't they? They can see right through us, can't they? And if they see us do one thing on Sunday and Wednesday, and then Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday and Saturday, we look completely different. They know it. We've got to live it. And it's interesting too, because usually if I want to know what a parent's faith looks like, you know who I look at? The kids. I can tell you a lot just by our students about the families that we have. All right, and the last one here is the Bible is timeless. The Bible holds all the answers for life and godliness and truth and all that. But we need to be able to communicate it, and we need to be able to be wise in how we do that. Every generation has its struggles, and I wanted to give you a glimpse into some of what our youth are dealing with today, and a glimpse into what a lot of us are potentially dealing with today. I really do believe that allowing our people in general, to think is the best answer, and that teaching them how to think is just as, if not more, important than teaching them what to believe. It's kind of like Matthew 23:23. You tithe the dill, the mint, and the cumin, and yet you neglect the weightier matters of the law, justice, faithfulness, and mercy. You should have done one without neglecting the other. We should teach the heavier matters, the weightier matters, how to think critically, how to ask good questions, without neglecting teaching them about the basic tenets of our faith. We have to think and understand and come to the knowledge of Jesus Christ, and that doesn't happen by mistake. We don't fall into Christianity. And if you have, then reevaluate. Us having the ultimate answer to life should make us desire to be the best thinkers that we can be so that we can communicate the answer to life to others. And so the question: how have you been thinking about God? If you've not become a Christian, now's the time. We'll talk to you about that. If you want help with that, come forward. We can help you think through it, talk about it, process it. But at the same time, if you think you need to come forward because you need help from the church, now's a great time as well, as we stand and as we sing.